your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm usually here every Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 7 with authors, editors, agents, and poets. But tonight I'm here a little bit early because Sharon Fong, who usually hosts Bridges at this time, is out of town. She'll be back next week. So if you're making dinner, turn the radio up, settle in, and enjoy. By the way, I've been asked about the music that plays at the beginning and end of the show. What you're listening to right now is the music of my husband and father, my son, Brian Barrett, his recording. He works around town most nights playing jazz and blues. Tonight I have two guests. My first is Louise Rafkin, and at about 6:15 I'll bring on Taylor Smith. Louise Rafkin is a writer and editor with 7 books, both for adults and children. Other People's Dirt, A House Cleaner's Curious Adventures, won her an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Her short stories have been widely anthologized, and her articles, essays, and reviews have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Poets and Writers, Metropolitan Home, and Out magazines, among others. She teaches creative writing at the MFA program of Antioch University in L.A. and makes her home in the Bay Area. Welcome, Louise.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good to talk to you after all this emailing back
exactly.
and forth. Your book is wonderful. How did you come to write it?
Well, I was house cleaning for years while I was writing at the same time and publishing books. And I got to the point where I began telling stories of my clients and things that happened on the job to people. And so many people were interested. It was amazing. And so at one point I started writing them down. And the first reading I gave, I looked out and I saw a rapt audience, so I knew I had something there. I don't think there's been very many tell-alls by house cleaners.
Are you still a house cleaner?
Occasionally. I miss it very much. I think I'm actually, I didn't do it this summer because I was on a book tour, but I think I'm going to return to work soon, and I'm going to house clean on my paperback tour. I'm going to go to a house in every town that I went to, because it's so odd to just go to a bookstore and talk to people, and I thought, I just really want to see into people's houses in Austin and wherever I get sent. So that's what I'm going to do this spring.
In a New York Times article I read about you, you called yourself a modern-day Margaret Mead. Why?
Well, I do feel like I'm an anthropologist, and the sort of home is a midden. I get to sift through the debris and the flotsam and jetsam of people's lives and figure out what it all means. And in each case, it means something different, whether it's a very wealthy person's home that has a penchant for, you know, I don't know, only eating olives, to someone else who collects, who knows, so many odd things out there, or someone who lets their ferret run around free, or many, many odd things can happen when you get into someone's home. And I feel like I'm able to sort of be this little anthropologist and spy.
You know, you always hear, write the kind of book that no one else can write. And this book, no one else could have written this book.
Good. I'm not sure I knew I was writing this book. It started out in very different ways and had some kind of sort of historical view. At some point I did a lot of research into house cleaners and the history of house cleaning in America and the unions and all kinds of things. And it became much more personal, a trip about why I was house cleaning and what I knew and what that meant about our culture. And you know, there also is sort of embedded here a big story about what it means to be an artist in this culture, that even if you're a well-published writer, you don't make enough money to live on, or many people don't. Some people do, but you know, the statistics show that writers need to have something else going on the side. And for me, it was a way of making a living and not having to sort of use my brain, and I just got to save my brain power for my work.
When did it occur to you to write about house cleaning? I mean, had you always been a writer and
yeah.
would journal about it or would write articles?
The first article was for the New York Times Magazine, and they were launching a section in the magazine called Lives that still runs. It's on the back page every Sunday. And they were looking for stories of contemporary life that sort of had a twist. And it was at the time where I started just sort of jotting down after my day's work the odd and curious things that would happen to me. And I would just write in my notebook, you know, free-range ferret, or divorce man never cleaned his house in 7 years, or, you know, I would just write little notes. I don't keep a journal. I sort sort of don't believe in that. But and I sat down and I sort of wrote about this way that I was earning a living, and sort of a better living than I could have done teaching at the time. And I am teaching again, and I do believe that I made more money as a house cleaner than I do as a teacher. But you know, the sort of irony of that and the housekeeper as spy motif, that people just think we're sort of not very smart, or we don't look at what we're doing, or, you know, I don't know. The stereotypes about house cleaners are many.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down and I wrote this very short essay of 1,000 words that affected very many people, some positively and some not so. There were some irate letters about just who did I think I was, you know, getting paid to spy on other people's houses and then telling the dirt on them, so to speak. And some people said, you know, I got letters from house cleaners that said, of course, you know, people don't see us. They see that we have a brain. It was interesting. And from that, I started developing the idea of a book about sort of an odyssey of, in the Homeric senses, how do you get from one place to another? And when you leave your home as a young academic or whatever I did, and you find yourself 10 years later in other people's houses, how do you get home, and what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. You, a few minutes ago, said you don't believe in keeping a journal. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm sort of not a protege, that's a big word, but I ascribe my writing thoughts and ideas to Grace Paley, whom I had as a young writer and who I continue to be in contact with. And I feel like a lot of people journal their thoughts into something so quickly that they don't have time to percolate, or they don't get to resonate with what else is happening in their life, and then it becomes sort of dead. And I do think you can't waste anything. I have, you know, sort of in front of me right now at least 25 post-its stuck up all over with little words on them that say, you know, Jim, or, you know, Bonnie Sink, or sublet in here, or, you know, all kinds of little things. So I don't want to suggest that I don't ever write anything, then I just have this steel trap mind or something. But I don't write down sort of what happened in my day. I sort of wait for it to sort of ricochet around in me and create something else.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of journals, you also have said that when you are cleaning somebody's house, you won't read their journal. That's where you'll draw the line.
Yeah, it's a sort of an ethical thing. I can remember my mother reading my journal as a teenager, so I'm still angry about that. And so that's where I personally draw the line. You know, I do actually sort of glance inside birthday cards every once in a while. And, you know, you're there when the phone machine picks up. You hear messages. There's just a lot of personal information in a house. But diaries are off limits. Also, Harriet the Spy was my favorite, absolute favorite book as a kid, and sort of my patterned my life after her. And her life was essentially ruined when her notebooks got stolen and people read them. So I've always felt like that's sacrosanct.
That's interesting. Will you read a few pages for us?
I will. I'll read from the beginning. It's sort of an introduction to everything, and the chapter is called 007 or 409, A House Cleaner's Humble Beginnings. I wasn't a particularly tidy child. I have never envisioned myself wiping other people's fridges, having a preference for a particular paper towel, or carrying a personal vendetta against stray pubic hair. I was one of those gifted, slightly precocious kids, curious, normal in some ways. I kept tortoises, and I was a Girl Scout. In the Girl Scouts, I earned badges quickly and without much effort. There were badges for pathfinding and letter writing, swimming and painting, each a colorful round patch embroidered with an enigmatic symbol. There was a badge for housekeeping. The stated purpose of the housekeeping badge was to learn the things that must be done to keep a home pleasant, clean, and safe. I demonstrated correct use of cleaning implements, mop, vacuum, and broom, and I executed both proper bed making and streakless window washing. I had to understand laundry sorting and money management, and I had to comparison shop for groceries. The patch itself was plain and uninteresting, a green field with a pair of cross skeleton keys, a foreshadowing of the keys to the houses I now carry on my cleaning rounds. The patch should have featured a pair of shackles instead. This regime was perfect preparation for a position as the ideal post-war wife. Nevertheless, in January 1968, when I was 10, Troop Leader Velma Buford signed off on all 8 of the official Girl Scout requirements, and I became a certified housekeeper. But I really wanted to be a spy, and there was no badge for spy. So I carefully watched I Spy and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Max in 99 on Get Smart. After reading Louise Fitzhugh's classic Harriet the Spy, I took to writing down everything I saw around me in the sparkling streets of my sprouting California beach town, just like Harriet in the book. I carried small journals clipped to my belt loop with braided colored plastic, a lanyard, which I changed regularly to match my outfit. I painted a sign that read Sinister Spies, and I hung it on our backyard tree. Each day before walking my spy route, I sat under my sign, trying to convince myself that I actually could sneak into the homes I spied on rather than simply peer into them from behind palm trees or juniper bushes. But I was too good a girl and couldn't bring myself to break and enter. Compared to the tough and fearless Harriet, I was gutless. Harriet had hid behind drapes and climbed into dumbwaiters, a device my Southern California brain could not even imagine. I soothed myself with reason. After all, I lived in a world of levelers. But like every spy wannabe, I was least intrigued with the obvious. I spent time stalking people I thought were weird, the widow whose huge graying underwear flew daily off a line strung out her back window, the large Mormon family with a mother who fed her baby from her huge brown nipple breast while walking around the house. Actually, not much ever happened. I had little patience and hated to sit for very long on the prickly ice plant outside the widow's windows, so most of the time I made up stuff. I wrote in my spy book that the widow had been married to a murderer and that the Mormon lady was really nursing the baby of one of her husband's four other wives. While I was busy trying to pry into the houses of strangers, interesting stuff was happening right close to home. One day I walked into my older brother's apartment to find hefty bags full of sickeningly fragrant tie sticks stacked up on the floor like throw pillows. Oddly, I thought these mounds of marijuana were quite normal, and I returned to spying on them. Eventually, the widow noticed me skulking about her house. One day, as I was sauntering out of the bushes on her side yard, attempting to look casual, she offered me my first cleaning job, 2 hours after school, 2 days a week, for $1 an hour. A way in. Although I did discover that her late husband had been a dentist, a perfect occupation for a murderer, I figured, all those drills and probes, the inside of her house proved no more interesting than what I had seen from the outside. I also found out, unfortunately, that you can learn a lot about a person from washing her underwear. After a month of undies, I quit. Most of us are taught to clean up, some by example and some by anti-example, by the folks from the do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do school. I was raised in an extremely clean home. Nothing was ever out of place, let alone dirty. Clean up your room. Although my father has been dead half my life, I can still recall the tone of his voice when he gave this order. My father was obsessively neat. He sorted his golf balls into a row of shoe boxes, dirty golf balls on the left, soiled in the middle, clean on the right. My mother did 2 wash loads daily, whites and colors, and was always attacking a closet for a spring cleaning, no matter the season in our seasonless town. Our once-a-week house cleaner, Lupita, did the heavy work, while my brother and I were assigned gender-specific chores. I was in charge of the bathrooms and the kitchen. He swept the garage and took care of the trash. Both of us have turned into our parents. He's a single dad whose kids suffer through daily room cleaning regimes, and I can't sleep if there's a dirty dish in the sink. I knew there were others who lived differently, amid mess and dirt and grime, but even then I didn't understand it. I had a friend whose hamster lived in the kitchen. Hamster poop pebbled the counter. The fridge at her house spawned stuff that might have started life in a petri dish. Trash cans in the bathroom overflowed with wads of tissue, nests of candy-striped dental floss, and matted yellow and brown cotton balls, like the fur off some dying animal. I tried not to eat at this house, which rarely proved to be a problem because eating necessitated unearthing a plate or a fork from under stacks of newspapers and piles of dirty laundry. Besides, if there was anything really edible there, the sometimes free-range hamster had probably gotten to it first. At a sleepover for this friend's birthday, I squatted over the toilet so that my thighs wouldn't touch the bacteria-ridden seat. Her older brother, a tall, pimply, bookish guy, intrigued me. He did his own laundry and kept a lock on his spotlessly clean room. And of course he grew up to be gay. In 1971, at the important age of 13, I somehow found myself in the running for Home Economics Student of the Year. I had sewed an A-line skirt and demonstrated proper dishwashing order. glassware, silverware, dishes, then pots and pans, and I had baked chocolate chip cookies and produced the exact yield written on the recipe. I had eaten a ton of dough, but I made the cookies the size of peanuts, so I got an A in cookies. In class, I tried not to upset our teacher, Mrs. Maven, a pinched, finch-like creature who had heart trouble and it was rumored would die if she got angry. I learned how to polish silver and properly scour a sink. It was the era of tie-dye bell bottoms and free love. People had even started to eat Chinese food with chopsticks. I knew if I won Home Ec Student of the Year, it would be like getting the award for being the biggest dork in the whole junior high. Of course, I was victorious. Dutifully, I wore the A-line skirt to receive my award. "You'll make some lucky man a great housewife," Mrs. Maven whispered, as she handed me a gold-edged certificate and then shook my hand. "Nice work, Betty Cocker," said Kurt Higgins, who stood next to me on the awards platform. His certificate, for P.E. Student of the Year, seemed unfairly cool. And once home, I threw out both the award.
Thank you for reading that.
Sure.
If you've just tuned in, you've been listening to Louise Rafkin reading from Other People's Dirt, recently published by Algonquin. This is Writers on Writing, KUCI 88.9 FM, and I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Curious, in terms of you as a house cleaner, is your house extremely tidy?
At this very moment, it's not so tidy, but usually it is. At this very moment, there's sort of, you know, my problem is paper. I'm not, you know, someday we'll get into a paperless society, I suspect, but I have just tons of papers. And so my desk is sort of full of little stacks. And I do have a dog, and that has sort of led me to the equation that it's often what you love the most that makes the most mess in your life.
Yes.
Because if I didn't have a dog, my house would be much cleaner. In fact, right now it's at my mother's in San Clemente, and so my house is very clean. But when she's here, it's just a constant, you know, constant vigilance of going around behind her. And I have this sort of theory that, you know, you could get a perfectly clean house, but you wouldn't have any love in it. I don't know if that's true, but I think there's something there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the publishing process. I'm curious if you wrote the entire book before you marketed it, or did you do a proposal and find an agent with the proposal?
I already had an agent, and I did write a proposal, and we went out with the proposal once the piece was published in the Times. And the book ended up substantially different than the proposal, as I think probably most projects develop. They do come out differently, but... And it was not an easy sell. People were very confused about, you know, who would buy such a book and, you know, where's the market? Who, you know, is it women? Is it men? Is it house cleaners? Is it people they clean for? Is it a cultural commentary issue? And it became more sort of even more complicated once the book got published and one of the larger chains decided that it was to be shelved in Household Reference, which, of course, made me really crazy. So, you know, it is a hard thing to do something that nobody's done, is to kind of write about something in a way that is sort of breaking new ground.
Yeah, that's a curious thing. Was it easy for your agent to sell your book?
No. Mm-mm. I think it was very difficult. It took the visionary folks at Algonquin, who's a really lovely literary press, and they also provided me... had an editor there that was pretty great for me to work with, a very smart woman. And so that was really great. I mean, I had a couple of options in terms of houses, and I definitely went with the more literary publishing house,
mm-hmm.
given that I wanted to, you know, I didn't want to write a how-to book with bullets here and there about, you know, the best way to do your oven or something.
Although I did learn in reading your book what order you wash dishes
yeah.
in. And then, of course, Home Ec came back to me. Oh, yes, silverware, glassware, okay.
Right.
So it had been shopped around before this house picked it up? And
yeah. We sort of went out over a period of months, and it takes a while, and I met different editors and talked about their ideas for the project, which is always, you know, sort of interesting to hear what they think you're doing and what you think you're doing and see how close that is.
Mm-hmm. Your book is somewhat of a memoir, and I'm curious if this also was by design, or did you set off wanting to write a book about house cleaning and include all the personal stuff, or what did you set out to do?
Well, it's curious because I have this sort of gonzo thing in me where I like to write about things that I do, and I like to have adventures, and somehow in the adventure I like something to be revealed to me about my life, and I'm always hoping that will happen. Most of the time it does. And that's sort of how I write. I don't know how to say what that is. It's sort of a mixture of a personal essay and reportage, I think. I don't know. That's how I see it.
Yeah. You also write fiction, yet most of your writing appears to be nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious what the difference is for you between writing fiction and nonfiction.
Well, fiction writing is just terrifically difficult and crazy-making. Nonfiction writing is fun and exciting. And right now I'm in the middle of doing both, and I don't know what to think about it. Because I think for me, you know, I was speaking last night actually on a panel about creative nonfiction and how the limitations of it are that you actually have to go do all these things. And at some point you just don't want to keep traveling or climb Mount Everest or live through a terrible storm or whatever it is. You know, actually, Sebastian did not live through the storm that he wrote about. But, you know, there's a situation that I'm interested in actually writing about that I have no interest in doing. And so then I'm face to face with, oh, I guess it's fiction. You know, how would this look if I did do this?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a very good imagination. I'm very delighted by the world's details and naturally crazy occurrences. So, you know, making up them, very hard for me.
Do your when you do clean houses, do your clients worry that they're going to end up in a book?
Some of them did worry, and some of them fired me. There's a story, and I got back at her because there's a story in the book about Cheerio Lady who fired me, and I call her Cheerio Lady because one year she had a big meltdown about me leaving two Cheerios in the sink, but the real truth is that she fired me when she saw me writing about that meltdown. And I always feel like I have the last word, although I did see her this summer when I was out on the Cape where I cleaned, and I ducked into an alleyway. So maybe she has the last word. I don't know.
The title is a wonderful title. Was that your title from the start?
No,
Other People's Dirt?
Unbelievably difficult to get. I mean, we probably went through 150 titles, literally. And my title was Dust to Dust, A Cleaning Odyssey.
Which is pretty good.
Well, I thought it was brilliant, and I thought it was very much about life and the transitory nature of life and some sort of spiritual quest, especially when I went to Japan and had the experience with the spiritual house cleaners. But the sales force and the publishers felt like it was too much like a dirge kind of thing, and people would think it's about, I don't know, funerals. So anyway, the publisher came up with this after literally we had different working title every day for about the last 2 months of working on it. You know, we said True Dirt, and we were just going to call it Dirt, and, you know, and then somehow Elizabeth Charlotte, who's a brilliant publisher at Algonquin Books, came up with it, and everyone kept saying to me, no, Elizabeth is really brilliant. She'll find one. She did. And also, I love the idea of having the word curious in the title, because that is something that's really important to me as a writer, is my curiosity. I feel like if I lose that, then I'm sunk.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that sends me into the world or into human experience.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with Louise Rafkin, author of Other People's Dirt. I'm curious, Louise, if you find, you just talked a bit about fiction versus nonfiction. I'm curious if your ideas naturally gravitate to nonfiction, or do you try to, when you have an idea for, say, an essay, do you think, is this a story? Could I make this a story? Or I'm going to make this an essay because that's easier to market. Do you go through all of those kind of somersaults, or do you just know what it is?
Well, mostly I sort of know what it is. And more over the last few years it's been nonfiction, although I did just start this big thing that may or may not be a novel, or it could just be an exercise in futility. I think part of my, you know, experience has been born out of making, trying to make a living as a writer, and that nonfiction or essays has been a way to do that, more than writing stories, as we all know. That you can get stories published. I've got, you know, quite a few short stories published, but you're not going to get paid for them. So once I quit my day job, which was probably 10 years ago now, I did start concentrating on thinking, this is something that could be interesting into the outside world, and how can I make it so? So, you know, I'm a writer without a trust fund. I hate that.
What is your process like? Do you do a lot of outlining?
I don't. I do go and have an experience. I just did an article, actually, about trying on bride's dresses. I'm 40 and I've never been married, and I wanted to try on wedding dresses. I had some sort of fantasy about it. And, you know, I didn't think about too much before, and I went and did it, and I brought a friend and who was about 70 who posed as my aunt, and we had this fabulous time. And then, you know, I sort of do it, and at the same time I make the little notes about what's going on. And then sometime in the next couple of days, things sort of filter in. And that's what happens. And then I sit down and over a couple of days write something. So as best as I can say, that's what happens, is that I do something and then I try to figure out what it means in the context of my life and sort of the bigger world. Mm-hmm. I'm rarely into that thing of, like, I don't know, the umwelt or the zeitgeist of some experience. How does it relate to the bigger picture?
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of, I think, something I read about you, something you wrote, always a caterer waiter, never a bride.
Yeah.
What was that in? Where did
I'm
that
sure
get published?
Where it is right now, actually, but it was about my, you know, I started waitressing and ended up cater waitering and, you know, writing about what I saw at these events. So, you know, anything that I do, I always think, God, there's got to be something interesting going on or I'm in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. So most of what you do finds its way into your writing?
Yeah, most of what I do. And actually, it keeps me sort of moving through the world and thinking, what do I want to do next? I just went to surf camp this summer in Southern California and wrote a couple essays about, you know, wanting always to learn to surf. And you know, I went out to do it in this sort of, I had a magazine assignment and thought it would be fun to be the oldest surf camp with a bunch of teenagers. But what happened was I fell in love with surfing and have been down there 3 times since the summer and bought a surfboard and a wetsuit. And so you never know what's going to happen. It can change your life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I try to make my life, you know, fear is that I'm going to get bored.
Mm-hmm.
That's the worst thing in the world. And when I find myself bored, I, you know, some writers I just have so much respect for. They can sit in a room and make up a whole exciting world for themselves. And as I say, I feel like I have to go do something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to find it inside of me.
When you started writing, did you ever think you needed to specialize and just do one thing? Because it sounds like you do a lot of different things. You write a lot of different.
I do. I write kids' books, and I have a couple of cartoon books. It's hard for me. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm really missing the boat by not specializing and, like, being the kind of person that has the name of, oh, she's this or she's that. But, someone was saying the other night, Michael Cunningham, the writer Michael Cunningham, was here reading from his incredibly brilliant new book, The Hours, and he was saying that he felt like he tried to be a painter, and painters either, like, want to go in and start drawing little tiny things, or they want their hands to really move around the room. And he felt as a writer that he was sort of, there's something inside you that has this sort of way it works and that you don't have a whole lot of control over. I mean, I don't think, I always remember the story of Isabel Allende in the room from whatever it was, 6 a.m. to 4 o'clock or something, and no one was to bother her. And she wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. I just couldn't do it. So I don't know whether that's a failure or makes me a dilettante or something, but I just kind of walk around the world collecting things that are interesting to me and trying to make sense of them. And that's exactly what I did as a kid with my notebooks and, you know, walking around the streets, writing down things or finding little things and making a treasure box. It feels the same. I don't feel any different. And, you know, who knows? That might change next year and I could write a screenplay or something. I don't know.
Some of your book definitely reads like fiction, especially one of the last chapters, A Yen for Cleaning, where you went to Japan to clean toilets. That is just too much.
It was amazing. It was just such a great experience. It actually changed my life in some way that I don't even know yet, because it was, I lived with these people who cleaned for free for their whole life, and they didn't have any personal property, and they just did this thing. And of course, in America, when everyone's so worried about what they're getting and how they're getting ahead or earning or not earning or better than, who are you going to be, it was such a relief and such a sort of terror to be among people who had decided that they would just do service for free and they would do menial service. It was very interesting. And certainly a valid way to live in the world. And, you know, things have happened to me since, like my neighborhood. I've gotten into sort of helping cleaning up my neighborhood instead of just complaining about it, which I want to do.
What keeps you motivated as a writer?
I don't know. I have this life now where I kind of get up every day and I am around or at my desk from 9 to 2-ish. And, you know, I'm happy to make a living such that it, as it is by using my brain and by doing something that's interesting to me. I, you know, the trade-off is that I don't make a lot of money. And maybe, you know, it's frustrating at times, that part of it. I won't say that it's not. But I also think I have an incredible amount of freedom and, for the most part, can sort of see that my life can be an adventure, which I really want it to be.
Your book sounds very much like you sound right now. I mean, the voice in your book is is you. Was that something you had to work at, or
no,
is that just how it comes out?
Well, I just write as me. You know, I don't. Occasionally, I get sort of poetic, and usually it's really bad. But, you know, I don't. I think it's hard. You know, when I'm around Grace Paley again, I have this idea that, boy, the way she writes is exactly what comes out of her mouth, and the way she is just. I mean, it's better than. And if I can ever, you know, sort of aspire to any think it is, because I can't be something I'm not in some way. I think that that's, I have a lot of early work that is sort of trying to be Raymond Carver or who else, many other people that I was influenced by. And I look back on it and I go, God, who was that? Why was she interested in that? And who did? Why is she writing it that way? So, you know, I'm getting more comfortable with who I am, like all of us do, I think, as we get older.
Who do you read, or what do you read?
Well, let me see. I just read a fabulously funny book by Mark O'Donnell called Getting Over Homer. One of my favorite books is Thomas Lynch's Undertaking book, which is another book about work. His book on being an undertaker is, I think, very brilliant. I read, it's not so much the people but the subject. I'm very interested in real life stuff. I'm very interested in work. I constantly go back to Plimpton and Joan Didion and people that are doing that kind of exploration in the world in some way. Grace Paley, always because of the truth that she gets out with very few words, I think. And also because she does write fiction and nonfiction, and some of it is really difficult to tell what it is. And so I'm interested in you know, what kind of reasons you write one way and what kind you write the other way. So those are some of the people, but mostly, you know, I read a lot, and I read a lot of magazines, and some of them, you know, like everything from Harper's Bazaar to Harper's, and, you know, women's magazines. I write a lot for Cosmopolitan right now, so I'm always trying to see what the current trend of things are in that way.
So when you're reading all these magazines, are you also reading with an eye to what can I do for them?
Yeah. I am. I definitely feel like at this point in my life I have some relationships with editors that I adore, and that's good, but you, as a freelancer, it's really hard, and you're always sort of thinking, I like this magazine right now. That seems like a good place to be.
Any advice for struggling writers who may be listening?
Well, you know what? Grace Paley told me 10 years ago, she said, I asked her the same thing. I said, Grace, what am I going to do? What should I be? You know, I actually wanted to be a dentist. You know,
because to clean people's teeth.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's, you know, it's like you get, it's a process, you get finished, and it seems perfect. It's quiet. People, you could listen to NPR all day. So I had this idea I would be a dentist, and I said, oh, no, no, you're a writer. And I said, well, what should I do? Because, you know, it's not like I'm going to make a lot of money. And she said, keep a low overhead. And it's really true, because I have seen so many writers. I lived in a writer's colony for several years amongst really talented writers, some of which who quit writing because it is so hard, you know, and especially poets who are just brilliant poets who, you know, get discouraged by marketplace and things like that. So, you know, I do feel like I don't have I've got a 1983 car, you know, I don't buy a lot of things, but I have my freedom to write, and that's a trade-off you make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that if you want to live the high life, it's really hard to be a writer. It's really hard to be a writer. I would actually love to live in New York City, but every time I've been there and stayed there or lived there for periods of time, I realize that I've spent so much money that I can't afford to do what I love there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I don't know. I mean, I guess there's always a trade-off. Or you can marry rich. That's my other advice. Marry rich.
Well, tell us how to find you on your website.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It's very new. Let me find it.
I suppose they could key in your name.
Could they?
I think so.
I think you could.
Yeah.
And
it's a wonderful website.
Yes, a friend of mine just is making it for me. It's very. It's on Zoom, which is I guess XOOM, and I can give the address.
Okay.
So can wait just a second. Maybe I can't. But I'm glad you went there. You might be my first visitor.
Well, they can contact me, and I'll tell them where
yeah.
it is. Or you can, you all can key in Louise Rafkin, and you'll probably get there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I just did that with another writer today and found a zillion books
right.
by him, just entering his name.
Good.
Well, I thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck to you, and your book, Other People's Dirt, is wonderful.
Thank you. It comes out in May from Plume, so those of you are keeping a low overhead, it will be
in paper.
Less money.
Paperback in May.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. That was Louise Rafkin, Other People's Dirt. We're going to take a short break, and when I come back, I'll be here with Taylor Smith, author of Random Acts.
The opinions and views expressed in this program by no means reflect those of UCI, its staff, or the Board of Regents of the University of California.
We're back, and my next guest, Taylor Smith, is in the studio with me. So good to see you.
Hi, Barbara.
I know Taylor well, but I could never remember all this, so I need to read your bio.
Oh,
because
okay.
It's very impressive. Taylor Smith is originally from Winnipeg, Canada, and has lived, worked, and traveled in Europe and Africa. Ms. Smith has a master's degree in international affairs. She's worked in the Canadian Foreign Service and has served as a Privy Council officer. A three-year diplomatic posting in East Africa left her with an abiding love for savanna landscapes and an ability to converse in Swahili. In her writing, she draws on her real-life experiences to create an involving, edge-of-the-seat story of scandal and intrigue. Taylor Smith is currently writing full-time and lives in Southern California with her husband and two daughters. You were here back in the spring when your third book, The Best of Enemies, came out, and now you're back to talk about your fourth book, Random Acts. How is it that you're so prolific?
Oh, God, I wish I still felt so prolific, because I'm so stuck on my fifth book, you wouldn't believe it. So, you know, all that prolific stuff, forget it. It's a thing of the past. I've kind of been cranking out one a year for the last year, and I thought I was doing really well, and it sort of started to slow down. And I think part of it is the process of publication, because you start thinking about the readers at the other end, and you start thinking about the critics at the other end. And I feel like one of those characters in the cartoons that has sort of a devil and an angel sitting on either shoulder. Only, unfortunately, it's the devil on my left brain shoulder, right next to my left ear, that keeps talking to me and telling me, this is garbage. This is such garbage. You don't know what you're doing. Whoever told you you could be a writer? So I don't know. It's really tough. I think prolific is really a thing of the past with me.
That's interesting because I think writers who don't have a book out yet believe that once they have a book out, that will never happen anymore.
You know, it's really reassuring to me to talk to people who are far better at this than I am and far more experienced at this than I am, to realize that I'm not as neurotic as I think I am and that it really doesn't get any easier. There's an incredible freedom that comes from just writing for the love of writing and not thinking about anybody else but yourself. I mean, it's just this wonderful ego-gratifying thing that you do. And that sounds, I mean, that's not as pretentious as it sounds. It really is enjoyable just to write for the sheer joy of it. And once the commercial starts to enter into it, there's a whole other aspect of the business that becomes very difficult to deal with.
So you really believe it gets harder? I mean, does it get harder for you?
I think it gets harder for me. And part of it, and periodically I go out and I read best-selling authors, and I'll name no names here, but a few best-selling authors whose work I'm not really struck on, and I think if they can do it, I can do it. And they're repeating themselves over and over again. And I'm always worried about repeating myself, and to the point where I go, oh, I used this phrase before, or, you know, this four-word expression before, and I can't ever, ever use it again. And then I'll go and read a really prolific author and realize, you know, if you read them back to back. I once went to an all-night drive-in movie and watched Woody Allen movies back to back, about six Woody Allen movies, and realized how often he uses the same jokes mm-hmm. over and over and over again, and realized that it's the same thing with published authors, too. So this fear of repeating ourselves, I mean, we all only have a limited amount of experience and erudition that we can draw on. So I'm trying to become less self-conscious about it and just kind of let the muse do its thing, but you become so hypercritical the more you do, and the more you worry about the little old ladies out there or little old men out there reading your stuff.
So is that the most difficult part of writing a book, is worrying about repeating yourself and doing something constantly new, or what is it?
For me, it's always coming up with the characters. I mean, first of all, for me, in writing a novel, character is everything. The characters have to be interesting. So I kind of worry a little bit about whether I'm writing the same characters over and over again. But also whether what I'm writing has some sort of emotional resonance with readers, and whether it's real, whether the voice is really right. It was interesting listening to Louise Rafkin talk about the voice and how your voice changes over time, too. Susan Isaacs is a writer I really like, and she has such a funny voice. And I like to think of myself normally as sort of a lighthearted, funny person, and I write so damn serious. It just makes me crazy. And I go, why can't I write in a light, funny voice like that? And I go back and reread stuff that I've read, and I go, it's so sober. Why can't I just lighten up? So, you know, you're hypercritical, and I never really can judge my stuff until well after I've written it. I just don't know when I'm writing it, whether it's any good or not.
Well, why don't you read a little bit?
Oh, gee, I have to find it. Because this is really upsetting. I've had emails from young mothers who just hate this prologue, and I promise them that if they can get past the prologue, they'll probably be okay after that. So this is the prologue to Random Acts, and it's italicized because we're in the head of a character whose head we're not normally in during the course of the story, but he's obviously the villain of the story. He was bottled terror ready to blow, and all the more dangerous for not looking the part. Hundreds of people passed by him that Friday night in the Southern California Mall. One or two even engaged him in casual conversation. But who would connect him to the monster and the panic he'd unleashed? He leaned against a pillar, contemplating with disdain the churning human sea before him, a tidal wave of Christmas shoppers intent on long lists and busy schedules, little people leading dull, ordinary lives. Most of them too weary, stressed, and preoccupied to take notice of him, standing at the edge of the central atrium, sizing things up, selecting a target. The teenage girls were another matter. Strolling in insular bunches of two, three, and more, they were as intent on seeing and being seen as on spending their meager allowances and babysitting earnings. He watched them lure awkward boys with their teasing, tortuous, sidelong looks, a ritual dance, primal as fear and twice as disgusting. Suddenly, two girls with mascara-fringed eyes and tight T-shirts emerged from the throng and passed close by him, making shameless direct eye contact, flirting with more danger than they could possibly imagine. His nostrils flared at the scent of cheap cologne that wafted before them like some flowery advance reconnaissance unit. He toyed momentarily with the idea of taking one of them and teaching her a lesson she'd never forget, but wouldn't live long enough to remember. But they weren't what he wanted or needed. He stared back until the silly things wilted under his blank, brutal gaze. They averted their eyes, arms crossing reflexively over tiny breasts, and hurried on. He continued to watch until they had disappeared down the mall's west wing. If they turned around or came back to spy on him, he had a problem. Would have to abort the operation. No, he wouldn't be deterred. Couldn't. He needed to act, to take control. Needed the addictive surge of power in his veins like a heroin rush. This time it would be even better. The panic would be greater. This time they'd know what they were dealing with and that they were helpless to defend against him. When the little snoops had disappeared at last, he turned his attention back to the ersatz North Pole erected in the mall's central court, where seasonal workers in green elves' costumes were trying to maintain some semblance of control over the confusion. Dozens of small children milled around, waiting for a chance to sit on Santa's lap and reveal their sweet, secret wishes to him. Eyes bright, smiles wide, they wiggled and chattered, oblivious to everything but sparkling lights and frantically gay music ringing out holiday tunes. He studied their faces, one by one. So enraptured, so innocent, such easy pickings. His gaze shifted from the line for Santa to the children riding the reindeer carousel next to his throne. One of them, perhaps. He liked the idea of his victim running a last, doomed race against the inevitable. The garishly painted reindeer seemed to glance sideways as they spun past him, their plaster eyes bulging in frantic, dumb perception of the danger he posed, straining at the bit to get away, only to orbit back once more into the inescapable pull of his will. Ride, he thought, smiling to himself. Ride like the wind, for all the good it'll do. His appraising eyes gravitated to the tiniest of the children, bouncing, chattering, giggling, as they waited to see Santa. He studied plump hands tugging grown-up sleeves, scrutinized round pink mouths from which spilled pure, high-pitched voices, examined chubby legs scrambling on metal guardrails. Which one? He asked himself, mentally pawing them, touching, sniffing, squeezing soft flesh like ripe fruit in a market, evaluating. Choose carefully, he told himself. The target had to be perfect for his purposes, as young as possible, beautiful but pliant. A baby girl this time, he thought, though a boy would have done just as well. He wasn't particular. All that mattered was that the sacrifice be worthy of his cause. Today he liked the idea of bows and curls, large dewy eyes, pink unblemished skin, every daddy's little dream girl. Suddenly his gaze connected with the wide blue eyes of a toddler, barely one, he estimated. She was in her mother's arms, curly blonde head resting on the woman's shoulder, staring sleepily at him while her small, moist mouth worked at a tiny pink thumb. He smiled back at her, entranced, grateful. She was the one. She was offering herself to him. She understood.
Well, you know, this prologue is very interesting because it was difficult for me. You know, I have a little son. But, of course, I wanted to read on. And then the first chapter is in such a totally different point of view in your main character, Claire Gillespie. But I'm curious about this prologue in terms of having kids, that you have daughters, and how difficult was this to write?
It was horrible. It was just horrible. And I don't know where it came from. And this is one of these really mysterious voodoo parts of writing, including writing fiction. It just comes to you and an idea grips you. You know, someone said that the ideas that most grip us deal with our greatest fantasies or our greatest fears. And I think for any parent, your greatest fear is always that thought of a random act of violence against children. It terrifies me. And when I wrote that prologue, I sent it off to my editor, and she said, "Ooh, this guy is really creepy. Are we going to see him again?" And I said, "Never. I don't ever want to be in this man's head again. I despise him." And it was really tough. And I honestly don't think I could have written it while my children were small. And I don't know where the story came from, except that I started to think about this novel about the time that all those stories were in the newspapers about the prom moms who were having babies in the bathroom mm-hmm. and then going out to dance the next slow one with their boyfriends. And that whole thought of a mother, of matricide, of mothers killing their children, of parents killing their children, is so appalling to us in our culture and in any culture, in any human culture. But I'd spent a lot of time doing research for my books, and I'd also spent some time at the Orange County Morgue. And I was in there one day and talking to the pathologist, and in the room where all the bodies are, and on the top shelf at the Orange County Morgue, there are a bunch of small wrapped bundles. And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "That's the babies." And I suddenly realized that every mother's fear, including my own, this random act of violence, is really a false fear. I mean, we know this from reading kidnapping statistics and reading about child kidnappings, that in fact the real danger to children doesn't come from strangers. It comes more often from people in their own family.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for better or worse, that whole idea just began to grip me about, you know, those random ghosts and goblins out there that we all fear as parents. And so I started thinking about the story, and it just kind of grew like Topsy.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, Claire is a wonderful character, and she's an investigative journalist,
mm-hmm.
and she's chasing a story in this book, and she is very feisty, and I'm curious how much of you is her.
I think probably a fair amount of me, although it's always interesting, because this is my fourth novel, and in fact it's my fifth and a half novel, because I have another one and a half novel sitting, you know, like most people, my unsold novel sitting in a bottom drawer that I've never sold. And when my first novel was published that featured a woman who had a background quite a bit like mine, people said, "Oh, did all this stuff happen to you?" And then my second novel that had a lot more graphic sex scenes, by the way, people sort of looked at me strangely and going, "Gee, she doesn't look like the type." And I'm beginning to realize by the time you get to the fourth novel, people are figuring out you can't possibly have done all these things, that it is fiction after all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are two main women in this novel, one of whom is a point of view character and the other one who is still a very main character. This is Laurel Madden, the FBI profiler in the book, who's searching for this random kidnapper of these children in Southern California. But of those two characters, I think anybody who knows me knows pretty well that I'm more Claire than I am Laurel, the tall, blonde, statuesque ice maiden. I mean, that's certainly not me.
You're blonde.
Well, yeah, but only my hairdresser knows for sure what color I really am. In fact, at this stage of my life, there's probably more gray than anything else in there.
I didn't see any.
We hide it well. but anyway, no, I think that Claire's attitudes and Claire's feistiness are probably there's a good bunch of me in there. And my sister is a journalist too, so to a certain extent, my sister is probably in there as well, and she's also a very feisty kind of character too, and doesn't take no for an answer. So, yeah, I mean, drawn on women I admire, I think.
Does your sister recognize herself when she reads this?
No, I don't know that she particularly recognizes herself, but it's always interesting when I go back to Canada and visit family members, and they'll look at me and go, "Yeah, I knew where you got some of that stuff." And I'm thinking, I mean, inevitably they're always wrong about the stuff that they think that they've narrowed in on, and or characters who think they recognize themselves in the book. And usually, if it's an unflattering portrait, if I've drawn an unflattering characteristic from someone I know, they never recognize themselves. But if it's a flattering character, they always go, "Oh, yes, I know you patterned that character after me." So it's an interesting thing that goes on. But I think my sister relates to her, though. And actually, the interesting thing about Claire is that Claire's apartment in New York, when I started researching this book, I was doing a promotional tour for The Best of Enemies, my previous book, and I was in New York. And before I started my tour, my sister, it was last year in Memorial Day weekend, and my sister met me in New York, came down from Toronto, and we hung out in Manhattan doing all kinds of fun, having a girls' weekend in New York. And we went to visit a neighbor of hers, a former neighbor of hers from Toronto, who lived in Chelsea. In this apartment in Chelsea, she's a graphic designer. And Claire's apartment is this woman's apartment. And so when I sent her the book, I said, "Thank you so much for giving Claire a place to live." Because this is always the interesting thing. I'm not a New Yorker, and yet Claire is living in New York. So I've spent, you know, two chunks of time in New York, basically, for any extended period of time. But I had to write about the city as, you know, as someone who actually lives there. So it's always fun when you can sort of pick up these bits and pieces, and hopefully it works for people. I haven't had any New Yorkers say to me, oh, this really doesn't work at all.
Well, you've said that you put off writing because your sister was a journalist.
Yes, yes, I did. My sister is a journalist now, but my sister, from the time we were very small, wanted to be a novelist. And my sister's heroine was Enid Blyton, the children's writer, and my sister was so determined to be a writer when she was a child that she had learned how to forge Enid Blyton's signature from the time we were very small. And because I'm a second-born child, and second-born children always want to blaze their own trail, I never wrote a word of fiction in my life before 1990. And then I moved to Southern California, and I took a leave of absence. And I didn't quit, but I took a leave of absence from my former career that you read about, that bizarre background that I have. And out of sheer boredom, I started writing fiction, and I took classes just for fun. I took UCI extension classes in fiction writing and just started to do this and was seized by it. So I always say my sister and I are going to be the Canada's answer to the Bronte sisters when we get old. If we can find a moor in Canada, we're going to walk the moors together in our old age.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I have here with me in the studio Taylor Smith, author of Random Acts. Usually my show begins at this time, and since Sharon Fong is out of town, she has the show before mine, Bridges, from 5:30 to 6:30. I've been on since 5:30, so Sharon will be back next week, and next week I'll also begin at my usual time, 6:30. Back to Claire.
Mm-hmm.
And your first chapter. After this prologue, you go into Claire getting woken up. She has a hangover. She's been partying. And it's a wonderful chapter, and it's a real grabber. And I'm curious how much work you did on that chapter to get it just right.
I drank a lot.
Did you?
Had a lot of hangovers. I don't know. It's really funny. I remember reading that in my writer's group one day, and somebody saying, oh, I'm just so sick of reading or listening to stories by drunks. And I'm, so, well, you know, when you need to forget and when you've had something difficult go on in your life, I mean, there is. That's one good way of getting away from it. But she's been having a tough time. Her husband has recently left her for her sister, and she's had an affair with an FBI undercover agent who she recognized. She's been an investigative reporter for quite some time and had spent some time in FBI headquarters and was doing a story on the Russian mob in Brooklyn and walked into a restaurant one day in Little Odessa in Brooklyn and recognized a fellow who she knew to be an FBI agent, and he was, in fact, working undercover. So he recognized Claire as well. And so in the process, he followed up with her later to make sure she wasn't going to blow his cover, and the two of them start a fairly hot and heavy affair, and then he proceeds to get himself killed. So when the story opens, she, in fact, is in the process of trying to find out why his killer hasn't been brought to justice, because there was an initial investigation of this guy's murder, and now the investigation seems to have dried up. And in the process of doing that investigation of this guy's death and investigating the Russian mob, He stumbles across the fact that this FBI agent had a wife, another FBI agent, a profiler. Claire knew nothing about the wife, and that profiler is, in fact, now in Southern California, tracking down this child killer. And Claire comes to believe that the profiler and her lover, in fact, had this guy killed rather than the mob. And so Claire sets out to try to prove this. And that's how she gets drawn into this story of the serial kidnapper in Southern California. So the story, the two stories kind of come together. There are these two story tracks that
it's
come together.
It's quite surprising what happens.
Yeah, well, I like to be surprising. I like to see how devious I can be. And that's one of the mysterious parts about writing this kind of book, is that the characters come first for me, and the general dilemma in which they find themselves. And I always know what the solution is. I always know what the last scene is going to be. And then the really mysterious process is figuring out how I am going to get there and how I'm going to keep the reader guessing all the way along, because it's so obvious to me what the answer is right from the outset. And so the trick is to try to write it so that it isn't obvious to the reader, too, and keep them turning the pages. I really, really like it when someone comes to me with big black circles under their eyes and says, you've kept me up all night with this ruddy book of yours. And I go,
oh, thank
so
you.
Nice. Thank you so much. What a nice thing to say.
Speaking of sleep or lack of it, I recall you saying that sometimes things come to you in your dreams and you wake up and have know something you have to do in your writing.
Yeah. I've learned not to obsess too much, although I'm beginning to obsess again these days because I'm having real problems with the book I'm working on now. But I've kind of learned to let go and let my subconscious work on things. That there really is a phenomenon that if you are having problems with something, if you just lighten up a little and take a step back, take a deep breath, and when you're going to bed at night, just say to your subconscious, give your subconscious some walking orders and say, I want you to think about this over the night. Almost inevitably in the morning, I will have moved a step along in the process, not necessarily right to the solution, but another little piece will have fallen into place. Or sometimes I wake up during the night and I've learned to trust sleepless nights as well and try to keep a pen and a piece of paper, because that's the other thing, is that you think it's so obvious and you'll remember it, this brilliant inspiration that comes to you at 3 o'clock in the morning, and inevitably you don't. Whatever seems obvious at 3 o'clock is not at all so obvious at 9 o'clock.
You had such an exciting life as a diplomat and a spook. Mm-hmm. How does writing compare?
Oh, gee.
Do you ever miss that life?
You know what? I'm not the kind of person who ever looks back. Uh-huh. Who ever looks back. It was really interesting to me to listen to Louise Rafkin talking about moving on and doing new things. And I think that, I don't know whether that's common to all writers, but it sounds like she and I have a lot in common, although she sounds like a much neater person than I am.
Your house is very neat.
Oh, you know what? Only because there are days when it's so hard to write that I'd rather clean the grunge out of the bottom of the vegetable bin in the fridge than sit down and write, but only because it's an avoidance technique. But if the writing is going well, my house is really dirty. Mm-hmm. So if my house is clean, it probably means the writing's not going too well because I've been avoiding. Mm-hmm. But what did I start to say? Oh, yes, she was talking about the short attention span, or what I define as a short attention span of writers. I think one of the reasons I liked being a diplomat was that you're always being moved around. You go someplace for two or 3 years, and then you get reassigned someplace else, and you're constantly reinventing the wheel and relearning new things. I don't think I could work at the kind of job where I would know 25 years from now I was going to get a gold watch, having, you know, screwed in my 1,150 millionth widget and spent 25 years doing that. I need to be changing all the time. I think journalism is really an interesting career from that point of view, too, that you're always having to mug up on a new issue, learn about a new issue. Mm-hmm. Diplomacy was like that, and writing novels is like that too, because I'm constantly going out to talk to new people about what they do and learning new things and trying to keep myself from being bored at the same time as I'm trying to keep my readers from being bored. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I really resent the fact that I can no longer travel first class around the world at somebody else's expense. But other than that, no, I never look back. I'm always looking forward to the next adventure.
Hmm. Well, I'm curious. I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but each of your books stand alone. They're, mm-hmm. they're not a part of a series. Was that your intention when you began writing, and were you ever pressured to create a series character, many are?
This is one of the problems I'm having at the moment, is that I'm writing a sequel to my first novel, Guilt by Silence, which is my Tom Clancy and drag novel. It's interesting. I've been out of political work for 8 years now. And I'm finding that the further away I am from it, although I'm still very current in terms of the issues, I have an academic as well as a professional background in international affairs, and I'm a political animal almost by definition, so I'm still very, very interested in politics and political issues. But the older, and maybe it's a function of getting older too, the older I get, the more interested I am in human foibles as opposed to, you know, the political process. Mm-hmm. So I'm now trying to write a sequel to my first novel, which was my Tom Clancy in drag effort. And my character, I guess, was Jack Ryan in drag because she was a female CIA analyst. And I'm finding, I don't know whether it's because of the political aspect of it or whether it's just because I'm not the kind of writer who was ever designed to revisit old characters. And I'm finding that really tough to keep myself feeling fresh when I'm dealing with the same characters again. So when I look at somebody like Sue Grafton, who's on, you know, Anne or O or whatever the heck it is she's on in her series, I am full of admiration for someone who can keep a series fresh over, you know, over that many books and using the same character over and over and over again. I think it's a real challenge. I mean, I think each of these forms is a challenge, just the way that a short story is an altogether different challenge than writing a novel. writing a series character is an altogether different process than writing a standalone novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, people who are ambidextrous, who can do all those things, really have my admiration. But it's, again, not as easy as it looks.
Hmm. You mentioned having a novel that under your bed or on your shelf that didn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
I have two, actually.
Two of them. What kept you going until you had one that did sell?
The first one that I wrote was in my heyday of, blithe oblivion about writing, and where I was just doing it for fun, no other reason. And thinking, because I was only on a leave of absence from my former job and fully intending after 2 or 3 years to go back. I was on something called leave of absence for the care and nurturing of a preschool-aged child. My youngest daughter was 2. When I took it, and the plan being that when she hit 4 or 5 and started preschool and kindergarten, that I would go back. And every fall, my office would call me and say, isn't she in school yet? When are you coming back? And I kept saying, next year, call me next year. And in the meantime, I started writing, and I thought, well, write what you know. That's the first dictum of writing fiction. So I thought, well, I'll I've got this interesting background. I'll write what I know. So I decided to write a novel set in a fictionalized African country. Frederick Forsyth did it with The Dogs of War, so I thought, well, if he can do it, so can I. And I wrote this novel about a mercenary, a French mercenary, and it was based on my time in East Africa. One of the countries that I covered when I was in East Africa was the Comoros Islands. And the Comoros Islands, just before I arrived in that part of the world, had been overthrown. The government had been overthrown by a French mercenary named Bob Denard, who had been fighting as a mercenary all over the world and was in his late 40s and wanted to retire. And apparently what a mercenary does when he wants to retire is that he overthrows the government of some pretty little country and takes it over. And that's what Bob Denard had done in the Comoros. And so I had to keep going to the Comoros Islands because we had Canadian aid workers mm-hmm. there. And I had to deal with this grotty government that was being run by this bunch of black-shirted mercenaries. So I thought, well, fiction is about conflict between characters, so I created this French mercenary who had overthrown this fictionalized African country, and I created an aid worker, because aid workers are, international aid workers are so idealistic, and I thought I'd just have these two characters butt heads. And I wrote that novel out of just the sheer joy of writing and discovering how much fun it was to create characters who were nothing, didn't exist until they invented in my head. I invented them in my head. And who came alive and began to talk to me and began to have lives and backgrounds and emotions and passions of their own. So I just had a lot of fun with it, and I was taking classes in the meantime. And when I finished it, I started sending it out, because that's what all the Writer's Digest guides say you should do once you have a manuscript. Mm-hmm. Then you start sending it out. And I sent it out, and it actually got me an agent. And the book never sold. Although my agent sent it around to, I think, maybe 2 publishers, and we started getting feedback on it, and they were saying things like, this person writes really well, and it's very interesting, and this isn't the book for us, but send us mm-hmm. anything else she writes. And fool that I am, I just went, oh, well, I guess I better write something else then. So I did. And the next one I wrote was Guilt by Silence, and I actually asked my agent to withdraw that first book because, after I had gone a year or two into the process, I reread it, and I went, this really stinks. It's just not as good. I could see all the problems with it, and I could see that it was a real beginner's effort, and so I pulled it back. And the other half novel I have sitting in my bottom drawer, which is a novel that I will finish one day because it's a story of my heart, is my great multi-generational Canadian epic.
Mm.
And that one I really love, but nobody wants to read about Canadians, I've discovered. So, when my name hopefully one day is as big as Margaret Atwood's or Alice Munro's, then, maybe mm. someone will let me write my Canadian epic. But in the meantime, I'm thinking I'm continuing to learn as I go, because that's the other interesting thing about having written a number of novels now, is that because I have a short attention span, it's only interesting to me if I'm continuing to learn something about the process of mm-hmm. writing. So every novel I write, I try to learn something new, some new technique, something I haven't done before. And so I'm thinking to myself, with my Canadian novel, I've learned that much more as I've gone along. So eventually when somebody does say, all right, we'll buy it, hopefully, it'll be that much better a novel because I've learned that much more in the process.
Well, what would you say is the most important thing to keep in mind when you're writing a novel? Is it the characters? Is it the conflict? What is it?
For me, first and foremost, it's the character. You can have all the pyro, and it's a matter of preference too, but you can have all the pyrotechnics and all the clever intellectual little plot twists that you want, but if your characters are not appealing, for me anyway, if the characters in a novel are not appealing, I will put the novel down. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that that won't be a best-selling novel. There are a lot of best-selling novels out there that have nothing but plot going for them, or have nothing but fairly decent storytelling going for them. There are a lot of writers out there who are really good storytellers, but very bad writers, in terms of any literary sense of writing. Mm-hmm. But they tell a really darn good yarn, and that keeps people turning the pages. And when I read a novel like that, it frustrates me. If the characters don't appeal to me, but the plot is strong enough that I'll keep turning the pages till I get to the end and realize that the characters never did appeal to me right up till the last page, it irritates me and I get really annoyed. But, you know, there are people who like that. There are a lot of readers out there who feel uncomfortable with the emotional life of their characters. Not me personally. Personally, I really like to understand the emotional life of my characters. So for me, they have to have an interesting interior life going on. But fortunately, there are as many tastes out there as there are, mm-hmm. writers mm-hmm. sitting behind their keyboards working. So I think that there's a novel for every taste. But that's what I'm looking for mm-hmm. is good, strong characters.
Okay. If you're driving down the freeway and you're punching buttons on your radio and you've landed here, don't go away. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, and I'm talking with Taylor Smith, author of Random Acts, and we have 15 minutes left, so do not go away. How about villains? You create really wonderful, multidimensional villains. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, I think one of the really important things to remember about a villain is that a villain has to be understandable. They say that even Hitler was good to children and could tell a good joke. You know, the kind of cardboard villain, who's sort of dastardly John tying Penelope to the tracks and who has no appealing characteristics at all, is not a credible villain. The reason villains are powerful is because they appeal to people. And you can, you can pick your favorite present political villain. I mean, whatever your political stripe is, just look at anyone that you really hate in the world, in the great public world out there, and realize that they have a lot of followers. And the reason they have a lot of followers is because in some respect they have appealing personalities. They know how to appeal to certain instincts or certain emotions. So I think it's really important to understand that villains have to be as multidimensional as your heroes and heroines. And by the same token, your heroes and heroines have to have weaknesses and foibles and faults. I personally cannot stand reading heroines who are tall, blonde, gorgeous, good-looking, wealthy, and talented. I just really want something bad to happen to those women because I cannot relate to them at all.
You are blonde.
I'll never live it down.
How does living in Orange County affect your work? Does it fuel your work at all? Does it matter little where you live? Do you think you'd write the same thing no matter where?
I don't know. It's a really interesting prospect because I didn't write until I came to Orange County. But part of that is a function of having had a lot more free time on my hands when I stopped working a 9-to-5 job. Part of it might be the fact that Orange County is so beautiful. And it was one thing that really struck us when we first came here. We came down, my husband and I, on a house hunting trip in the winter, in February or March of 1990, to look around and see whether we wanted to make this move to Southern California. And we left Canada in February, and it was horrible and cold there, and came down to this gorgeous place with palm trees and greenery and said, this is a really beautiful spot. But it's so beautiful that at a certain point you kind of want to lift up the carpet and look underneath to see if there's dirt underneath mm-hmm. the rug because it's almost too attractive. And then, of course, if I were being really snotty, I could also say that the place is so perfectly sterile that your imagination tends to start looking for some mm-hmm. stimulation and looking for a little excitement because the place is almost too perfect as well. But I don't know. Now that I've gotten into the habit of writing, and everywhere you go, this is the other thing. I mean, Louise Rafkin was talking about cleaning people's houses. I mean, God, I mean, how could you let her into your house? You'd always be worried about what she'd be looking at. But I think that for writers generally, you always know that people are kind of wondering whether what they're saying to you is being written down in some corner and whether you're finding inspiration. And in fact, it's probably true. I mean, there's my sister's friend's apartment that ended up in Random Acts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are characters I've met who've ended up in my books, never in whole, always in part. I've never created a character except for the golden retriever in Random Acts, who is, in fact, my golden retriever. except for that dog, I have never created a character entirely on anybody I know. They're always sort of bits and pieces of characteristics. But you always look for inspiration around you mm-hmm. in everything you do and everyone you meet.
Well, it's interesting. There are a lot of literary writers in Orange County, but there are an awful lot of mystery writers. And I just find that interesting.
Yeah, I think it is that phenomenon of the place is just too darn good to be true. And so mm-hmm. you do kind of want to see what's underneath the surface there. And you just have this sense that any place that looks this good must be evil under the surface.
Your dialogue is awfully good, too. And I'm curious, what helps you in writing dialogue?
It's an interesting thing because I find that this is something I've tried to work on quite a bit through the various books as well, is to try to get it to flow a little better. But I think being a listener really helps. I think that my previous incarnation in this case really helps too, that I spent 12 years working as a political analyst and a writer for very, very demanding people, for politicians, for ambassadors, for prime ministers, for ministers of cabinet. Who always wanted things written their own way. And it's a bit like being a journalist and writing for different media, too. You know, you write differently whether you're mm-hmm. writing for a newspaper or a magazine or for radio or for television. Each of them has their own style and their own flow. And at a certain point, if you've written for a lot of different media and you've done academic writing and I've done political speeches and I've done diplomatic dispatches and I've done political analyses, at a certain point, you lose all pride in what you're doing. You no longer have any ego left, and it just becomes a question of getting the voice right. And so I think that for fiction writers, that having had that kind of broad background, that serves us well. That people who've written in a lot of different fields, you find a lot of journalists who've worked in different fields who become very good fiction writers because they become good at listening to voices and to writing according to the demands of the particular mm-hmm. medium for which they're writing. So I think that's got a lot to do with it. And I think the other thing that probably helps too is that I come from a family of oral storytellers. Mm. My mother was one of 13 children. And they grew up on a homestead on the Canadian prairie. My grandfather was a sodbuster. And living in the middle of the Canadian prairie in January when it's 40 below and the wind is howling around you, and in my mother's day, of course, there was no electricity, mm-hmm. no radio, no television, what happened was they became veteran storytellers. And because there were 13 of them, they're intensely competitive and always trying to one-up mm-hmm. one another in terms of the tall stories that they would tell. So I grew up all my life listening to my aunts and uncles and my parents sitting around telling stories without end. And you get that real sense, I think, at a certain point of the rhythm of the story and, mm-hmm. and what your audience wants to hear mm. to keep them interested.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about voice in terms of dialogue. The voice of the narrative of this book is very much how you sound to me. Mm. Talk a little bit about that, just getting the voice of the narrative down.
It's an interesting process, and it's one that I think at a certain point you can't intellectualize too much, because I know that every time I try to intellectualize the voice, and voice is a concept I think that comes to us really late as writers. I remember taking courses, literature courses, as a student and trying to understand the concept of voice and not really getting it. I think it's one of the last things we come to understand as readers and writers. And at a certain point, I think you just find what your natural rhythm is. I know that when I read someone like a Susan Isaacs, for example, whose voice I really like because it's so funny, and I wish I could write like that. And sometimes we'll try for an exercise to imitate it. But at a certain point, it's like trying to walk in a rhythm that's not your own. You know, you can try to walk like John Wayne for so long, but at a certain point, you know, your own physiology is going to take over, and you're going to walk the way you walk. And at a certain point, I think your own voice takes over too. And I think that when we stop trying to write like someone else is when our writing becomes its best, mm-hmm. because we're writing in our own voice.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Susan Isaacs. What else or who else do you read?
I read really eclectically. I read a lot of nonfiction for research and for personal interest. The writers that I run out and buy right away are Susan Isaacs, John le Carré, who I've always loved, and that's partly because of the political background and partly because the man is such a master of characters. I mean, I don't know that there's ever been a better character in fiction than George Smiley. I just love that man. I like Alice Munro, who's a Canadian short story writer.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing voice. There's another Canadian novelist named Margaret Lawrence, who is not anywhere near as well known as Margaret Atwood, and who died, unfortunately. She only wrote about a half a dozen novels and died, but she has one of the most amazing voices I've ever heard. Laurence. I really would recommend people go out mm-hmm. and find her. She's incredible. I love her voice. I like Martin Cruz Smith a lot. Again, a great character. He wrote that trilogy, Arkady Renko, the Moscow investigator. I love Martin Cruz Smith's voice. I think it's really good. And then all my friends. Right, I read all them, too.
Of course.
Of course. But, I try just about everybody. I'll tell you something interesting. I just had an interesting experience. I was just back east last week, and flying home on the plane, I was in Boston. I went, of course, to check out all the airport bookstores to make sure my book got an airport slot.
It's everywhere.
Oh, it's just so exciting, too, when you see it everywhere. But I picked up The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks, and I thought, this book has been on the bestseller list for so long. Read it. It's the kind of book, I mean, it's 213 pages long or something, and it's the kind of book you can read easily in one sitting. I mean, I read it before the movie even started on the flight back from Boston. It goes really fast. And I was really struck by this book. This one, The Bridges of Madison County, The Horse Whisperer, which I haven't read, but I've seen the film. And I'm looking at all these guys who are doing incredibly well writing women's fiction. It's just so amazing to me, these stories that they're telling. And this is not to diminish the stories. I mean, they're interesting stories, and they're great emotionally involving stories. But these are stories that women writers have been writing forever and sort of have been dismissed and shoo-shooed off to the side as women writers. It must be a 90s thing or a millennium thing that suddenly all these male writers have found emotion and are being lauded for having found emotion. It boggles my mind.
Tell everybody where to find you on the web. You have a website.
I now have a website, and it's www.taylorsmith.org. And the reason it's .org and not .com is because apparently there's an engineering company called Taylor Smith, so they got to com before I did. But www.taylorsmith.org. I'm an organization now. What do you know?
Well, check out the website. It's wonderful. And you're wonderful, and thank you for being here.
And you are, too. Thank you so much, and happy holidays.